We spent a couple of Sundays talking about the subject, Let Your Light So Shine. And hope we increased in wisdom and ability to do that. We could next ask the question, well, to whom are we going to let all this light shine forth? And the answer is our neighbor. And then we could ask the question, as a Pharisee asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? So today, we hope to discuss the parable of the Good Samaritan in various aspects, sort of take it apart here and there, and decide in our own minds who is our neighbor. Now, I'm sure we already know who our neighbor is. In church, we review these things time and time again, and occasionally some new light comes forth. I'm getting old enough, I don't mind going over and over them again. I seem to always pick up something that's new from somebody somewhere. In the course of learning who our neighbor is, I think that we'll also review some New Testament geography. I think we'll find that rather interesting. I'd like to read the parable to begin with. It's found in Luke chapter 10, and there are various places that you could quit, but it's pretty good to go on clear to 37 to sort of get the picture. Now, you will recall it from time to time, as Jesus traveled around, that the scribes or the Pharisees or others would be present. And oftentimes these men would sort of try to do him in. I think in that day, as a matter of fact, in just a generation or two back from us, there was much more discussion in public and whatnot than there is nowadays. Nowadays we're confronted, particularly in a cultural community like our own, with so many things that something sort of gets sunk. In former times, the talk, the soapbox speech in the park and whatnot was very popular and was always going on. We don't see too much of that nowadays. The president of BYU has a dickens of a time getting enough of us to go to the forum assembly to hear a speech just once a week. My own father, when he was young, used to go to the City Hall Park in Ogden and get up on the soapbox and speak out in favor of socialism. He wasn't a Mormon then, but he used to be a great one to get up there and speak his piece for socialism. When he was converted to the church, he firmly renounced the whole business and became as free enterprise in his thinking as any man I've ever known. Well, in Christ's day, there was a lot of this. Now, you have to recognize that the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but particularly the Pharisees, had become more important in that day than the priesthood. The priesthood still existed in that day. I'm sure it hadn't come down in too pure a form, but the Aaronic, the Levitical priesthood was there, and it was at work, and there were officials in the Jewish faith. But as time had gone on, the Pharisees and others had become interpreters of the prophets, so to speak. I think we sort of have an equivalent in our own modern day, and I think we have to be careful. I would not want to point anyone out, but don't you think that we have professors at our own BYU in the Department of Religion who have a greater following, so to speak, than the prophets themselves who are right in our midst? Now, up to a point, I'm sure that is all right, but I do think we have to be careful, and I can see a parallel. Members of various Jewish councils who were not members of the priesthood and who were not the church leaders had become the important people in the church. And people looked to them. They didn't look to the priesthood leaders, the regular ones. They looked to these people for their counsel and advice. Now you see, Jesus was busy pointing out the errors of these scholars, these interpreters of the law, who had assumed more importance than the legal priesthood of the Jewish church. And so there were these confrontations from time to time between Jesus and these people. And this happened to be one of those situations. Pharisee was there, and he was just sort of putting Jesus on trial, so to speak. Well, this was a lawyer this time. It wasn't a Pharisee. And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tempted him, saying, the lawyers were closely associated with the Pharisees. They worked together. And tempted him, saying, Master, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? He said unto him, that is, Jesus said unto him, what is written in the law? Well, the dickens, you're a lawyer, you know what's written there, is what Jesus was saying. Why ask me? You know. How readest thou? In other words, how do you interpret the law? And the lawyer answering said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and thy neighbor as thyself. Well, that's just about as straightforward and beautiful a statement as the man could have given. And Jesus said unto him, thou hast answered right. This do, and thou shalt live. We could sort of interpret that Jesus, you know, go live what you believe. Sure, you know the law, but now go out and do this. This do, and thou shalt live. But the lawyer, willing to justify himself, said unto Jesus, and who is my neighbor? Well, I'll come back and comment later. If I keep commenting as I go on through, I'll never get to the end. So let me just keep reading. And Jesus answering said, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, which stripped him of his raiment and wounded him and departed, leaving him half dead. And by chance there came down a certain priest that way, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. And likewise a Levite, when he was at the place, came and looked on him, and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion on him, and went to him, and bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and set him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn, and took care of him. And on the morrow, when he departed, he took out 2 pence, and gave them to the host, and said unto him, take care of him, and whatsoever thou spendest more, when I come again, I will repay thee. Which now of these, Jesus is addressing the lawyer, which now of these, thinkest thou was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? And the lawyer said, he that showeth mercy on him. Then said Jesus unto him, go and do thou likewise. Looks like the chalk disappeared. No, it didn't. There it is. Now let's read this again and look at some parts of it. The opening statement of the parable caught my geographical interest right off, because it says, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Now, when I go to Salt Lake, I go up to Salt Lake. What do you do when you go up to Salt Lake? You go down. Do some of you go down to Salt Lake, or does everybody go up to Salt Lake? How many go up to Salt Lake? Okay. Well, I don't know if that's habit or what it is. When I used to live in Ogden, I went down to Salt Lake. But I think we tend to think of the normal geography. We see the map on the board, and that's up, and that's north. See, so if you go north, you go up. I think that's a general tendency with people, but I have seen a situation when it isn't. Well, now in this case, going down to Jericho from Jerusalem. Here's Jerusalem right there. And Jericho is not shown on this map, but it's down here about 20 miles away off in this direction, so sort of east. But now I decided to look at the various elevations in this area of Jerusalem, and literally in this case it is going down, because Jerusalem is 2,600 feet above sea level, and Jericho, which is over here, is 800 feet below sea level. So you go down 2,000 feet, it's pretty steep all the way. And I think maybe in that case, that's what they said. They probably said, go up to Jerusalem when they were down in Jericho, because you really were going up. It was a long, hard climb. Now, just to review a little geography of this area, Palestine. In the time of the Old Testament, this was the situation. Now, here in the north, you have the Sea of Galilee, and some 65 miles to the south, you have the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea. Now, this is interesting because we have a parallel in Utah, and I have a map of Utah. The National Geographic once ran a parallel on the similarities between Utah Lake, the Jordan River, Great Salt Lake, and the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and the Dead Sea. And there are a lot of similarities, but there are a lot of differences also. Now let's come over here. We have the reverse situation. The fresh lake is in the south. In the Bible lands, the fresh lake is in the north. Now the saints, of course, when they came here to Utah, saw this similarity, and so they named the river connecting the two the Jordan River. But now the Salt Lake, you see, is in the north, and the distance is shorter. This is only something around 25 miles in this case. Over there at 65 miles. Now, how much higher is Utah Lake than the Great Salt Lake? Does anybody know the elevation of the Great Salt Lake above sea level? It's 4,100 feet. Well, the lake over there is not that high at all. I've forgotten the number. Maybe it says. The Sea of Galilee is actually below sea level, 682 feet below sea level. So you see, elevation-wise, there's a lot of difference. 4,100 feet above sea level. Oh, I'm sorry, I mixed the lakes up. This lake, here, Utah Lake, of course, has to flow that way, so it has to be higher. It's approximately 4,200 feet. Let's see if it says on this map. No, I'm wrong. It's 4,489, and the Great Salt Lake is 4,195. It's almost 300 foot difference in elevation between these two lakes. Now over here, the Dead Sea is 1,292 feet below sea level. That makes it about 600 feet lower than this one. But that is the lowest point on the surface of the earth. There's no point on the earth itself proper, you know, up on the surface that is lower than the Dead Sea. You go right here on the shore, 1,292 feet below the level of the sea. Jerusalem, you see, is just about opposite, westward from the northern end of the Dead Sea, right there. Okay, now, this city they went down to, what did I say it was?
Jericho.
Jericho is just down through this, I don't know if you pronounce that Kidron or Kidron Valley, right on down like that, somewhere around 20 miles. Now, what do you remember about the city of Jericho? You ever heard of that before? What'd they do with the city of Jericho that stands out in your mind?
Joshua fit in.
Yeah, that's right. There's a song about it, isn't there? When the children of Israel first crossed over this river, they came to the vicinity of Jericho. And remember, they marched around the city with their trumpets and their shouts, and the city walls fell down. Well, now, in Jesus' time, the city of Jericho was a city in which many of the Levite priests lived. And the road between Jericho and Jerusalem, was a road that always had robbers along the road. It seems that the traveler is always in a precarious position. It's been that way throughout all history. You have a road to go along, you have people are going to rob the stagecoach. If you're on camelback like they may have been in early times here, there'll be somebody there to catch the unwary traveler, extract some huge duty from him legally, or else extract some duty from him illegally, you know, just take away his money. Out on the ocean in former times, you had pirates. Anytime somebody was traveling, it was dangerous. Now, we had a pretty good period in the airline history here up to about 10 years ago, and then we started having air hijackers and air pirates who were going to get the traveler or get somebody. Well, that's an old danger of any kind of travel. Going to be pirates or robbers or hijackers. Highway robbers is the word, you know, along there to take care of you, get your money or something. So this was known to be a dangerous road. And so in various discussions of this parable, some people think that it may not really have been a parable. And even if it had been a parable, it had probably happened to many people that they'd been robbed along there, and probably some had come along and helped in some cases, and some had in others. All right, now we need to talk about the Samaritans a little bit. The Samaritans were the most hated of all people by the Jews. Now let's see if we can find out some of the reasons for that. If you go back to the Old Testament times, this shows the division of the kingdom among the 10 tribes. Here's Manasseh up here. Judah, you see, was in this part. Benjamin was a small part here. Simeon, Dan, Ephraim, Manasseh, Gad, Issachar, Zebulun, and so on. Well, now, there came a point in Bible history, remember, where the 10 tribes were carried off into Syria. Here's Syria up here. Okay, now which of the 10 tribes got carried away? Or which ones were left? Judah. Well, that accounts for one. What's the other tribe that was left? Benjamin. See, Benjamin was sort of under the wing of Judah here. Okay, now I don't know how the Syrians came down. I'm not knowledgeable enough in history. No, they got down here and got this tribe and all the rest of them. And I really don't know the details of how they survived here. Well, there came to be a land up in here on this New Testament time map known as Samaria. For some reason, Samaria in this area seemed to be a land where those who escaped, now you know if they come and try and take away these 10 tribes, they're not going to get all of them. Some of them would have escaped, some of them would have hidden out, and somehow they would manage to stay behind. Well, they went into this land and hid out in this general area. Well, Syria repopulated this land. After taking the 10 tribes out, they repopulated it with complete foreigners, Gentiles, so to speak, to all of these tribes of Israel. And there was intermarriage between those who escaped and the foreigners who came in here. So the religion of Judah was in this area, but it came to be there in what the Jews considered a very perverted form. They had here the Pentateuch, the first five books of what we call the Old Testament, but they rejected, the Samaritans rejected the rest of what we call the Old Testament. The Jews clung to the rest of the Old Testament. They also claimed relationship to these people. And the Jews didn't want that relationship. Now, the Jewish people were very exclusive in their nature. Now, I'm not saying that's particularly bad. Carried too far, that was bad. But the Jews would not have any kind of relationship whatever with the Gentile if they could avoid it. But with the Samaritans, it was even worse, because the Samaritans were the lowest people on the face of the earth in the eyes of the Jewish people. And so that's one reason that this particular parable has so much impact. Here, the most hated of all people, a member of the most hated people of the Jews, was the one that rescued the traveler who had been beset upon by some robbers. Now, let me tell you a story that I think I can relate somewhat to this. I have a Jewish friend. He's still my friend, although I only see him about once every couple of years because he lives in another part of the world. But I was closely associated with him for quite a number of years. Interesting situation in which there were three of us working in the same room all the time, a Catholic fellow, Jewish fellow, and myself. So we had a few discussions here and there. But now one day we were in a discussion about this was not the Catholic friend at this time, this was another guy who had come in. We were having a discussion about how he had bought something and he paid too high a price for it. And just out of my background here out in Utah, I happened to say, well, why didn't you Jew him down? And not even thinking. And this Jewish friend, he doubled up his fists and he got red in the face and he really jumped on me. But he let out an oath. You know, kind of oath that many people use concerning the Father and the Son. Don't you ever say that again, he told me. Really mad. Well now, what should I do? This Jewish fellow swore all the time. He took the name of the Savior in vain and the Father in heaven. He talked dirty all the time. He used pornographic language. Now he's no different than other people. He just had to be a Jew. All my white friends did the same. Too common in this day and age. And of course, in the case of Watergate, we finally found out that it's in government too. Our congressmen, our presidents, our senators, they talk like this. The presidents of companies talk like this. It's very discouraging. But you see, here was a man, he was offended at what I said. Of course, I said what was wrong. I shouldn't have said, why did you Jew him down? That was a reflection on him. But what my Jewish friend didn't realize is that while I had sort of insulted him, he had been insulting me for years, you know, by his swearing and by his vile talk. Well, what should I do? What do you do in a situation like this? Brother Evans, what would you do?
Depends on what kind of rapport I was on with him. Like, if I felt, I don't know, like someone like Jimmy here or something, probably just bring it up, you know, and say, well, you're doing the same thing in that way. I don't know, if he was a dignitary of some country, it would be kind of a different situation. You just have to go by that, I guess. I don't really know.
Yeah, I think that's right. It would depend on the circumstance. It would depend on my personality, his personality, and many other things. Well, what I did, I apologized. So I didn't say anything about my being offended by, you know, what he'd done many, many times. And I haven't to this day. But I have often wondered in my own mind if I shouldn't have someplace said something. Now, a lot has to do with my personality. I think perhaps I don't have enough guts, so to speak. I probably should have apologized at that time. And then maybe a few days later, when he let out some kind of an oath, have said, hey, Joel, that's not his name. But, hey, Joel, you know, that language, I don't like to hear that too much. Or something like that. But I never did. And to this day, I haven't. But when I go to see him, which I occasionally do, he still swears in my presence. But you know, if I ever said in his presence, why don't you join down? I know what would happen again. So I would never say it again. I'm converted to not saying that. Well, I think Jesus was trying to teach us in this parable that everyone is our neighbor, even the most hated of persons. We may not like the guy who lives next door. We may not like a person of that race or the other race or something, but no matter how bad that person is, he is our neighbor. Now, sometimes our neighbor is not liked by us because he offends us. Now, I like my friend, and I still liked him. I just wished he would quit that sort of language. But there are instances where our neighbor is so offensive to us that we do not have any love in his heart. Now, the key to loving our neighbor, I think, is in this turn the other cheek, which Jesus told us to do many times, in various ways. For example, one time, was it Peter who asked him how many times he should forgive a trespass against him? Well, that's sort of like this lawyer. Who is my neighbor? He wanted Jesus to spell it out. You see, the lawyers and the Pharisees invented or derived from the 10 basic laws given to Moses. Thousands and thousands of specific do this, don't do that in detail. And that's what the lawyer was after. He was, give me some detail on who is my neighbor. And he wanted Jesus to say, well, certainly the Samaritan is not my neighbor. And the Gentiles out there, they're not my neighbors. And things like that. But we're supposed to not pay any attention to that. Everyone is our neighbor. And if we're offended by our neighbor, turn the other cheek. And if we can turn the other cheek, he'll still be my friend. Now, I don't know, in the case of this Jewish friend of mine, if I had immediately, you know, doubled up my fist and got all red in the face and said, don't you ever swear like that again in my presence either, you so-and-so. I just say this simple little thing, and here you are using these oaths all the time. Maybe we wouldn't be friends anymore. Somebody has to turn his cheek somewhere along the line. If we would all do it, we probably wouldn't have the wars and rumors of wars and troubles that we have. I'm not anti-Semitic, and I don't want to, I know in my heart I'm not anti-Jewish, but I have observed some things of the Jewish culture down through the years that are interesting. During World War II, I came in contact with quite a number of Jewish people and other people, of us who were Caucasians, Americans, European extraction, whatever you want to call it, were not behaving any better. But this interested me. You know, war is a bad time in that men are out away from home. There's many temptations, and they get in all kinds of troubles, particularly in the realm of sex, as you well know. Well, I found out that a lot of the Jewish boys felt, I'm not breaking the moral code if I have sexual intercourse with the Gentile girls. It's only if it's with other Jewish girls. See? And I learned that to be very prevalent. But I'm sure that, like I say, those of us who are of European extraction, whatever other extraction, also probably had some similar mental rationalization as to how come they could go out and do the things that our Father in Heaven would not want us to be doing. But there was that particular rationalization okay with the Gentiles, just so he don't do it with the Jewish ladies. Well, now, let me read down here a little more and see what else we might find in this particular parable. Well, the first man that came by was a priest, and it's very likely that that priest came up from Jericho. Because as I told you before, Jericho was a place in Jesus' time where the Levite priests were located. Sort of, you might think of it as sort of a monastery if you want to. There was a, in the, this walled city of Jericho, I guess the walls had been rebuilt, there were many Levite priests. Now, they knew better. They knew this law just as well as this lawyer. Love thy neighbor as thyself. But then, you see, who is your neighbor? The question comes up again. Let's rationalize away who is my neighbor. Now, there are problems. I recognize there are problems. Particularly in this day and age, if I'm driving along the highway and I see someone in trouble, they have their hood up or something, I will often say to myself, well, a patrolman will be along and help them out. And why do I do that? I do it because I'm scared. Because you have read in the newspapers of people who you stop to help, and they shoot you or something. Doesn't it happen? It's a trick, see? It's a trick. They lift up the hood of their automobile, and it's a lonely stretch of Nevada road or something like that. And they have a jack on and the wheel off like they got a flat tire or something. And so you stop to help. And... well, I read about something like that just a month ago. Happens all the time. So you're scared. It may be a ruse or a trick. And you figure, well, maybe I better let somebody else come along and handle it. I don't want to get shot. Now, that's too bad. But it does happen, and it does make it so that we rationalize that way. All right, now let's see. So a Levite came. Who else was it that came? There was one other man. Well, a certain priest, and then likewise a Levite. I don't know what the difference would be there. How about you New Testament scholars? If the Bible calls one a priest and the other a Levite, there must be some distinction.
Yeah, not all Levites were priests, only the direct descendants of Aaron.
Only the direct descendants. Did the Levites do some function even though they were not perhaps ordained as a...
Oh,
I see. Well, the one that would be ordained would be a Levite too, though, wouldn't he?
Yeah, priests were Levites. All Levites were priests.
Well, that may be the distinction that's made there. All right, now, it's interesting that Jesus himself traveled through Samaria, and that got him in trouble. You see this red line here from Jerusalem over on the other side of the river and over into here? The reason they had that road was because the Jews were afraid to go through here. But Jesus didn't take that road when he went. He took this road right through there. Now, on one of his trips, he came up through here to Jacob's Well, which is near this city of Sychar. Can any of you tell me what happened at Jacob's Well? Remember the story? This one is a for real, and this one's not a parable. Well, let me tell, I think some of you guys know the story. Well, I'll refresh your memory. They came to Jacob's Well. Now, Jacob's Well is an old well, you see, clear back into Old Testament times. And there was a woman of Samaria sitting at the well drawing water. Jesus' disciples had gone to the nearest town, which I guess was this town. Jacob's Well is actually a little bit further away than this town of Sychar. It's a little ways away. I think the Bible scholars think maybe, I think the figure of 8 miles runs through my head. It seems a long ways. Maybe it was that far. The disciples had gone in there to get some meat, something to eat. And Jesus was tired, and he sat there by the well. And then he took up a conversation with this Samaritan woman. And I can't paraphrase it too well, King James Version, but it's really beautiful the way it talks about it. But somehow or other, Jesus asked the lady for a drink of water. And then she said, well, how come you asked me to get me a drink of water, since I am a Samaritan? And she recognized him as being a Jew. And she says, you know that the Samaritans do not have any relationships with the Jews. They hate each other. Well, anyway, he left her with the impression, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a Samaritan. You're my neighbor. We're brothers and sisters. But he told her that he could give her some water. He called it living water. And there was an exchange back and forth. She very much wanted this water because in her mind, Jesus told her that she would never thirst if she had this water. In her mind, she thought, oh, I'd take one drink of this water and I'll never need to drink again the rest of my life. It's apparent that that was her first reaction. But as time went on, she eventually realized and came to know that he was the expected Savior of the world. Now, one thing that really convinced her is that he asked her to go and fetch her husband. And she says, well, I don't have any husband. And Jesus politely told her that she was lying. She had 5 husbands. And not only that, she was living with a man right now who was not any of those 5 husbands. But anyway, she became convinced that he was indeed the Savior. And she went out and fetched everybody in the town to come and see him. And he tarried there 2 days. Now I assume that during those 2 days he was preaching to them. Now, later on, you remember that the apostles, the Acts of the Apostles, they had great success in gaining converts to Christ Church in Samaria. And probably Jesus stopped there. He was headed up here, you see, for the Sea of Galilee. He stopped at Jacob's Well. Contact with the Samaritans there was a forerunning thing that made it possible for the apostles to convert so many from that area. Now there's another interesting mention of the Samaritans. One time, in this banter back and forth between Jesus and the lawyers and the Pharisees, they accused Jesus of being a Samaritan. And not only being a Samaritan, but he was a Samaritan and he had a devil. Now, you see, that was sort of the worst kind of abuse that could be heaped upon a person who claimed to be a Jew, is that he was a Samaritan, and in addition to that, he had a devil. I thought the treatment of the man who was wounded by the thieves was interesting. They bound up his wounds and poured in oil and wine. Now, I tried to read through ancient writings as to just what that treatment was all about. But all I could learn is that that was a typical treatment of the day. Somebody had a bad cut, stab, slash from a sword or something. But the treatment was to pour in oil and wine. Now, the wine containing approximately 12% alcohol would have been a fair antiseptic, probably. You know why wine doesn't contain any more than 14% alcohol?
Some grapes don't make it.
Yeah, the bacteria that make it kill themselves when the alcohol gets up to that high, you see. They can't live in alcohol that's any richer than 14%. So to increase the alcoholic content, men invented things that we call stills, and they can get the alcohol content up to 95% in a still. And if you want absolutely pure alcohol, then they couldn't do that till a chemist came along and learned that you only get out the last 5% of water by a chemical reaction. You take calcium oxide and dump it in there, and it picks up the rest of the water. Well, yeah, the bacteria create the alcohol as a waste product, and they swim and live in there until the concentration gets up to about 14%, in which they commit suicide. So 14% alcohol will take care of quite a few bacteria. Now, I wondered about the oil part. I don't quite understand that part. No doubt the oil was olive oil. And olive oil is an unsaturated oil. Now, you've heard a lot of talk on TV about polyunsaturated fats and whatnot. I can give you a 2-minute lesson on that. There are two basic kinds of oil. There are mineral oils and there are vegetable oils, and they are different. Now, we did not have mineral oils, and at least not extensively, until petroleum was discovered and utilized. Petroleum, oil well stuff, gives you an oil that is a hydrocarbon. You have a long chain up to perhaps 24 carbon atoms, and then there are hydrogen atoms. Carbon atoms, all you guys remember from your high school chemistry, form bonds four ways. 1, 2, 3, 4. Tetrahedral. We have an expert here. Well, now, it's just a long chain like that. Now, vegetable oils, and olive oil would have been a vegetable oil, are what chemists call esters. They're made from glycerol, which is a tribasic alcohol. Doesn't make you drunk. It's good stuff. United with an acid. So it's more complicated. And when we say it's an unsaturated thing, it means there are two bonds in here in places between carbons. Now, what these bonds can do, these double bonds, can react with oxygen of the air. And in addition to that, they can react among themselves to make a skin. Have you ever heard of linseed oil? Linseed oil is also a vegetable oil, unsaturated. And when you paint it on wood or something, it reacts with the air, and the double bonds open up to react and form a skin. Forms a tremendous molecule with millions of atoms in it. So in my mind, since I couldn't find anything, I had to invent it, why they put in the olive oil. In my mind, they put the olive oil in because it's sort of like putting a paint. It's a wet paint. It forms a protective skin, just as linseed oil does, which has often been used as a paint. So maybe the old-fashioned treatment wasn't bad at all. I think they need their roll back there. Anybody know where the roll is? I think next time I get a cut, I'm going to try that. I don't know where I'm going to get the wine, but I can get the safflower oil or the corn oil off from the shelf and put that on there. Okay?
We're talking about oil, so I don't ask, but the difference is the double carbon bond between what? Mineral and...
Well, mineral's a lot of difference because it's just one straight backbone of carbon atoms. I didn't want to take time to draw the rest of the molecule.
Oh, but,
Well, what it means is that you have these double bonds in here. And you want to know why? How come that's better? In the fatty oil, you have an ester arrangement in here, so it's much more complicated. Mineral oil is not nutritious to the human body. Our enzymes and our hydrochloric acid in our stomach and whatnot do not break mineral oil down. It's a laxity; it just goes straight through, undigested. But these vegetable oils and fats are cleaved by the enzymes in your digestive system, so they break off the glycerin at this point, set all of these free. Then there's an acidic group on here which can react chemically, And then these double bonds can be broken to chop the molecule up into smaller units, which your body can digest. So our body can digest vegetable oils. Now, the other thing, why are these better? Well, if you take coconut oil, there are hardly any double bonds in it. Double bonds can be attacked chemically. Single bonds can't. So these do not get digested, and they think they accumulate in the bloodstream. Does that answer any of your questions on that?
I think in Japan they sell the, like some kinds of machine oil and stuff to cook eggs in, you know?
Oh, yeah. You have to watch that in foreign countries.
Yeah, what does that do to you? Does that really ruin your system?
Well, if the oil were cleaned up, you know.
Huh?
But petroleum oil contains a lot of various things in it. If it's distilled and cleaned out of this pretty white mineral oil, it wouldn't hurt. But what too often happens, and many people have been killed from this. I heard that in the Near East, this same area we're talking about, these Arab traders who are sometimes unscrupulous, were selling oil out of the crankcases of airplanes and whatnot, you know. And diluting that olive oil with that kind of stuff. Well, now that is bad, because if it were just oil, it wouldn't be so bad, but additives are added to those oils. Phosphates, organic phosphates, and many other ingredients are added to increase the lubricity of the oil, and they're poisonous. And I remember reading in the newspaper a number of years ago of hundreds of people being killed because some unscrupulous guy over here was taking off the oil from American equipment somehow and diluting his olive oil with it, and people were cooking with it and died. Yeah,
it's a lot cheaper, you know.
It used to be a lot cheaper, but you know, now with oil prices up the way they are, the things may well be
back to the fish oil.
Back to the fish oil. Well, that's enough on that, I suppose.
Quick question.